the headlines. An official from the Saudi Aramco oil company says one of tankers, its jet distribution plant, is still out of action a day after Yemeni attack on the facility. The U.S. General Services Administration asserts that Joe Biden as the apparent winner of the presidential election, clearing the way for the transition from President Trump to begin. Anger's boiling in Brazil as people march in southern city to protest the killing of a black man who was beaten to death by white guards. Our top story for this half hour. Saudi Arabia's state oil company has confirmed an attack on its distribution station in the northern city of Jeddah. An Aramco official said the attack caused a fire at what he described as a critical facility. He said one of the 13 tanks at the facility was damaged and is now out of service. Yemen's military earlier said it had struck the site with a Qutz II-type missile. It said the attack was in response to Saudi crimes and aggression against Yemen. The military said operations against the kingdom's interests will continue. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The conflict has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calls on the international community to help end the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. Zarif, in a tweet, stressed that the invaders and their masters who are trading Yemeni lives for money must be held to account. He said that ceasefire and an end to Saudi bombardments are the only viable paths to resolving the conflict in the impoverished Arab nation. The top Iranian diplomat noted that such steps would also allow the urgent delivery of humanitarian aid and start of political dialogue. Zarif's remarks came in response to a tweet by the UN Secretary General, who warned that Yemen is in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has witnessed in decades. International lawyer and activist Barry Grossman says the UN Security Council is one of the entities which created the Yemen crisis.
We have branches and organizations within the General Assembly which quite rightly denounce the ongoing tragedy in Yemen. While at the end of the day, one of the key architects of this tragedy was the UN Security Council. I think it's almost impossible not to reach the conclusion objectively that from the beginning, this tragedy was set into motion as a result of the embargo created by the UN Security Council, and of course the United States, Great Britain, and France together, working with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to basically wage a belligerent, illegal, foreign-based war on Yemen in order to prop up an individual, former President Hadi, who had lost all legitimacy, had overstayed his elected term, which he obtained unopposed. The Security Council and the key players on the Security Council have been completely unwilling to do anything except to continue to profit from this belligerent war.
The U.S. federal agency that must sign off on the presidential handovers told projected winner Joe Biden that he can formally begin the transition process. In a letter to Biden, General Services Administration's Chief Emily Murphy said she will make available sources and services to go ahead with the power transition. President Donald Trump said in a tweet that he has recommended to the GSA head to do what needs to be done. But he insisted that he was still refusing to concede, saying that he will keep up the fight to challenge the election results. The agency has been under pressure to free up millions of dollars in funds, office space, and briefings for Biden's team. The president has so far refused to concede defeat in the November 3rd election, claiming the vote was rigged in favor of his Democratic rival. Police in Chile have clashed with anti-government protesters in the capital, Santiago. Police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the demonstrators. People were in the streets to oppose efforts by Chilean President Sebastián Piñera to stop the advancement of an opposition-sponsored bill. The bill aims to allow citizens to draw down a second installment from their privately held pensions. The government says the measure, among other things, implies a cost to the public purse that can only be determined by the executive. The president has said he would appeal to the Constitutional Court to halt that. Supporters say the bill helps those struggling with economic hardships caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Hundreds of flights have been canceled in Shanghai's biggest international airport after a small cluster of COVID-19 cases in the city was linked to several cargo handlers. Officials say over 500 flights out of Pudong Airport were canceled on Tuesday. Health authorities say thousands of staff were tested. The incident also prompted plans to give high-risk workers at the travel hub an experimental vaccine. Since July, China has been providing an experimental vaccine to state employees, international students, and essential workers heading abroad. The coronavirus first emerged in China last year. The country has largely brought the pandemic under control by enforcing restrictions and lockdowns. But the battle for the containment of the disease, the domestic outbreaks in different cities, still continues. Our correspondent Stephen Rebay is joining us now from Beijing. Stephen, tell us more about this scare at Shanghai's biggest international airport.
Well, the cancellation of hundreds of flights, I think, reminds everybody of how this disease started and spread to the entire world. And that was that it started in a big airport city, Wuhan, in central China, at exactly the wrong time. It was the run-up to Chinese New Year, when people were leaving Wuhan and going not only to every corner of China, but everywhere in the world. So obviously they're not going to make that mistake twice, and that's why they're cancelling all of the flights from Pudong Airport, where they have surmised that the virus came in this time. Having said that, however, China, the latest news I've heard is that there have only been two locally transmitted cases yesterday. That's the latest figures available. There are 20 more, but they all came in from outside China. They're in quarantine. They really don't count. They're not going to be spreading their virus to anybody. The two locally transmitted cases, one was in Tianjin and one was in Shanghai. So I think China's very confident this is going to be clear to zero soon hereafter. They're very confident in the measures they have used to suppress this disease, which have been proven without any doubt to have been the most effective in the entire world. China has achieved something incredibly, just remarkable, bringing the virus down to zero several times and squashing new outbreaks when they occur. And how has it done this? Well, you said it, mass testing. In Tianjin, they've tested over 2 million people over the past few days in the Binhai new area of the city. In Shanghai, they've been more selective in their testing. They're just testing everybody who's associated with that airport. And then on top of that, they're introducing lockdowns to people who have had contact or anywhere near these outbreaks. In Tianjin, for example, they shut down a kindergarten and moved all of the teachers, all of the students, all of their family members to a centralized quarantine space. And they sealed off residential compounds where cases were found. These measures have been criticized as draconian, but I don't think China really cares, and it's hard to believe that anybody who levels those criticisms really believes them, because China, as I said, has shown time and time again that it can just squash this disease when it rears its ugly head. And I think it's fair to say that the whole world envies China for that. Okay, they're nervous now more than they otherwise would be because the cold weather has returned, especially in the north of China now. But at the same time, I think China is very confident that its approach has been shown to work and that it can very quickly bring these new outbreaks down to zero. And then soon after, life can return to normal. That means no masks, no social distancing, no cancellation of mass gatherings, which is just incredible in the world to see this in China.
Thanks a lot, Stephen Ray, joining us from Beijing. The clashes have erupted in the southern Brazilian city of Porto Alegre during protests against the killing of a black man. by two white security guards. Police fire, tear gas, and rubber bullets to disperse protesters who hit officers with stones and fireworks. The protesters also occupied a street outside a Carrefour branch in Porto Alegre. The chain store has faced a wave of boycott calls as well as violent protests outside its branches across Brazil. That has happened after the death of black man João Alberto Silveira. On Thursday, he was punched to death by security guards at a Carrefour store. His death has drawn comparisons with anti-racism protests that rocked the U.S. back in May. China's embassy in the Philippines has denounced the United States for what it called creating chaos in Asia, saying the U.S. aims to serve its interests. The reaction came after a trip to the Philippine capital by U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien. The Chinese embassy in Manila said the visit was not intended to promote regional peace and stability. The embassy urged Washington to stop what it called inciting confrontation in the South China Sea region. It also urged the U.S. to stop making irresponsible remarks on the Taiwan and Hong Kong issues. The embassy stressed that those issues are purely China's internal affairs. During his Manila visit, O'Brien underscored Washington's commitment to Taiwan. He also expressed U.S. support for the Philippines and Vietnam, both locked in maritime rows with China. A UK-based rights group says Myanmar is ignoring orders of the International Court of Justice about its treatment of Rohingya Muslims. The Burma Rohingya organization said in a report that the country continues to commit genocidal acts against the ethnic minority group. It added the Myanmar government and military are calculating that they can safely ignore the provisional measures of the top UN court while avoiding any consequences. Earlier this year, the ICJ demanded that Myanmar cease its genocidal acts against Rohingya, prevent the destruction of evidence of crimes against Muslims, and report back to the UN every 6 months. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have fled a brutal military crackdown in Myanmar to neighboring Bangladesh since 2017. The UN has described it as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Thousands of Kashmiris are living in a constant fear of death and destruction amid continued hostility between India and Pakistan on the line of control dividing the disputed Himalayan region. Our correspondent Shanapat has traveled to a village on the Indian side of the de facto border and filed this report.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach this mortal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parvez Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off, although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
France says it's launching an investigation into clashes that broke out after police cleared out a new migrant camp in Paris. Interior Minister Gerald Darmani said images of the scuffles were shocking. He said he was seeking a full report into the incident. Images have been posted on social media of police hitting demonstrators as they moved in to clear the camp of what they called illegal migrants' tents. The camp emerged just a week after police had cleared out another migrant campsite in Paris. France has joined other European states, such as Italy and Britain, in taking a tougher stance on migrants since a refugee crisis in 2015. Spain's Catalonia region has eased COVID restrictions on the food service and hospitality industry in a bid to restart the economy following a steady decline in new coronavirus cases. The reopening, which extends to culture, sports, and entertainment, does not envision a return to normalcy. An unpopular 10 p.m. curfew would be maintained well into 2021. Kuzai Ketri reports.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down, because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects the COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment, and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. As Americans grapple with how or whether to gather with loved ones this holiday season, the roughly 2 million people confined in the nation's prisons and jails face an even grimmer challenge: how to stay alive inside a system being ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic. What you just heard was from an article authored by the editorial board of the New York Times under the heading, America is letting the coronavirus rage through prisons. Please stay with us for more of the New York Times article. It's both a moral failure and a public health one. Like the nation overall, United States correctional facilities are experiencing record spikes in coronavirus infections this fall. During the week of 17th of November, there were 13,657 new coronavirus infections reported across the state and federal prison systems, according to the Marshall Project, which has been tracking these numbers since March. The previous week saw 13,676 new cases. These are by far the highest weekly tolls reported since the pandemic began. With winter descending, the situation threatens to grow bleaker still. The American penal system is a perfect breeding ground for the virus. Squabbles over face masks and wearing masks and social distancing are essentially moot inside overcrowded facilities, many of them old and poorly ventilated, with tight quarters and with hygiene standards that are difficult to maintain. Uneven testing, inadequate medical resources, and constant churn off of staff members, visitors, and inmates further speed the transmission of the virus. Crueler still, inmates suffer disproportionately from comorbidities, such as high-level high blood pressure and asthma, putting them at an elevated risk for complications and death. 8 months into the pandemic, the precise shape and scope of the devastation remains difficult to pin down, but the available data is heartbreaking. As of mid-November, more than 196,600 coronavirus infections had been reported among state and federal prisons in the United States. More than 1,450 of those prisoners had died. The case rates among inmates are more than four times as high as those of the general public, and the death rate is more than twice as high. Inmates are not the only ones trapped with the virus. The correctional system employs more than 685,000 people. These are prison guards, nurses, and so on. There have been more than 45,470 reported coronavirus infections and 98 deaths among staff members to date. Their case rates are three times as high as for the general public. Of course, these are the reported cases. The real numbers are assumed to be higher. The coronavirus ripples outward from these hotspots, engulfing the families and communities of inmates and workers. The coronavirus does not respect prison walls any more than it respects state or national borders. It will not be confined. This spread poses a particular problem for rural communities. 40% of prisons are in counties with fewer than 50,000 residents, which typically lack the healthcare infrastructure to deal with such outbreaks. Even a modest outbreak can quickly overwhelm local hospitals with scant numbers of ventilators and intensive care unit beds. Local jails face additional challenges. Whilst prisons report much larger case numbers, the rapid turnover in jails, where many people are confined for only a few days or even few hours, enable the virus to circulate swiftly between inmates and the larger community, and makes tracking all that much more difficult. In a report last month on outbreaks in the Mountain West, the New York Times noted that in Cascade County, infections at the local jail made up about a quarter of all known cases in the county. Over 2 months, the facility knowingly released 29 people who were considered actively infected. As with so much about the pandemic, this is a problem that should have been dealt with more aggressively early on. There was a call for reducing overcrowding through early release and other decarceration measures. While some progress has been made, it has been uneven and inadequate. Prisons and jails experience declines in total population. Approximately 11% of the incarcerated population in the first half of 2020, according to a report on decarceration put out by the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. The report notes that these reductions appear to be mainly the result of declines in arrests, jail bookings and prison admissions related to lockdowns and the closure of state and local courts. It continues, the releases among sentenced jail and prison populations that have occurred have, for the most part, occurred on a case-by-case basis and have been procedurally slow and not well-suited to crisis situations. While many jails saw a population drop during the first few months of the pandemic, the numbers of people being held in jails began climbing again over the summer, according to a September briefing by the Prison Policy Initiative, which analyzed 4,451 county jails. In 88 counties, jail populations are higher now than they were before the pandemic, the briefing notes. Some states have taken legislative action to speed the decarceration process. A bill signed by New Jersey's governor last month permits prisoners with less than a year left on their sentences to be released up to 8 months early. This has already prompted the release of more than 2,000 people, with another 1,000 or more releases anticipated. All too often, though, continued foot dragging or dysfunction by prison officials requires the courts to step in. In the spring and summer, the San Quentin State Prison in California had a major coronavirus outbreak. Built in the mid-1800s and early 1900s, the outdated facility suffered from overcrowding, inadequate medical staffing, exceedingly poor ventilation, extraordinarily close living quarters, and inadequate sanitation, according to a panel of medical experts from the University of California at Berkeley, who were brought in to assess the situation at the prison in June. But by late July, the number of active cases had topped 1,600. Tents were erected to house the sick. Before the outbreak faded, around 2,200 inmates had confirmed coronavirus infections, and 28 inmates had died. In addition, 298 staff members were infected with the virus, resulting in one death. The problem continued to fester. In late October, a state appeals court ruled that the prison authorities' efforts to address the issue had been insufficient and that inmates' constitutional protection from cruel and unusual punishment was still being violated. To deal with the emergency, the prison was ordered to cut its population by around one half through a mix of releases and transfers. It should be noted that the original outbreak was sparked by the transfer to San Quentin Correctional Facility of infected inmates from another prison. Clearly, more needs to be done. The report by the National Academies outlines best practices for reducing the incarcerated population, broken down into short-term and long-term solutions. The suggested measures start with a systemic commitment to diversion efforts such as non-custodial penalties for minor infractions, including probation and parole violations, and the limiting of pretrial detentions through means such as reducing or eliminating bail. In addition to offering guidance on a bolder decarceration effort, the report stresses the importance of minimizing risk to the families and communities involved, such as offering testing prior to release, a place to quarantine in the community, and examination of parole and probation policies and procedures. More comprehensive and more standardized testing and reporting requirements are also needed. Managing this kind of crisis is not a one-and-done effort, the report emphasizes. It is a process requiring sustained engagement with a wide array of actors at all levels. It is all too easy for many Americans to ignore the horrors of what is happening inside the nation's prisons and jails. Inmates are isolated from the broader population, their suffering kept out of sight. But their welfare in this pandemic remains inextricably linked to everyone else's. The nation's continued failure to bring the coronavirus to heel among this vulnerable population is both a public health catastrophe and a moral one as well.
The debate.
Struck a Saudi Aramco oil distribution facility in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. Now, this is considered a major achievement for the Ansarullah fighters who have accused Saudi Arabia of waging an uneven war against them. In this edition of the debate, we will look at why Saudi Arabia is continuing a war that it is losing and whether it can even continue this war when it is dealing with an economic downturn to support a very expensive MBS adventure.
The Yemeni army says it has fired the winged Qut-2 type missile that struck a Saudi Aramco oil company distribution station in the kingdom's Red Sea city of Jeddah.
The strike was very accurate, and ambulances and fire engines rushed to the target.
The army spokesman described the attack as a response to Saudi crimes and aggression against Yemen. He warned foreign companies working in Saudi Arabia to exercise caution as operations against the kingdom's interests will continue. This is not the first time that the Aramco facilities have come under Yemeni attacks. In September 2019, the Yemeni military claimed responsibility for strikes on Saudi oil plants that knocked out more than half of the kingdom's output. The Yemenis say such retaliatory attacks are to push Saudi Arabia to end its devastating war on the impoverished nation that began in March 2015. The onslaught has killed tens of thousands of Yemeni people, many of them women and children. According to the United Nations, Yemen is faced with the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, with nearly 80% of the country's population in need of humanitarian assistance, including more than 12 million children. Nonetheless, calls from rights groups and world bodies for an end to the Saudi aggression have fallen on deaf ears in Riyadh. Advocacy groups such as Human Rights Watch have documented evidence of war crimes in Yemen, calling on Western countries to stop arms sales to Riyadh. They argue that the weaponry is being used in the war in Yemen for civilians are bearing the brunt of the kingdom's military campaign. Saudi Arabia triggered the Yemen conflict with the purported aim of restoring the former government of Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi to power and ousting the Ansarullah movement. But years of deadly war and crippling blockade have failed to bring the Yemeni resistance movement to its knees. On the contrary, it has made significant progress in developing weapons to carry out retaliatory attacks. Now the kingdom, having failed to achieve its goals on the battlefield, finds itself caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, Saudi Arabia could suffer irreparable harm from the Yemenis if the war lasts further, while on the other hand, the kingdom regards it a disgrace to end its campaign without achieving any of its military objectives.
Joining us for this edition of the debate, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, Michael Springman, joins us from Washington, D.C. We have activist and political commentator Hossein Abulkhaiti, who joins us from Sana'a. I'd like to welcome you both. Hossein Abulkhaiti, let me first start with you and get a reaction from you. You're looking at a missile that has struck the Saudi Aramco oil distribution facility. And what is very significant about this fact, aside from where it has struck, is that this is some 600 kilometers or 370 miles from the frontier. So it's really quite an achievement in terms of the depth of where this missile hit, which is the distribution facility.
Yes, I mean, this exactly show you that here Sana'a forces are actually capable of sending those type of missile deep inside Saudi Arabia. We remember that on the attack that have targeted the Baqiq oil field and as well the pumping the oil pipe pumping station north of Saudi Arabia and Yanbu, those area actually are much far than Jeddah, but still Saudi Arabia sometimes they deny that those type of missile maybe will come from Yemen as they did after the Baqiq oil field attack. But in the same time, they are actually recognized that some attack on Riyadh and as well on Yanbu, which is are more far, they are from Yemen. And I think this show you that Yemeni are well equipped to conduct those type of attack and as well to attack one of the largest city in Saudi Arabia, which is Jeddah and which is in the Red Sea, after an attack that was conducted 2 weeks ago by explosive boats against as well a floating oil facility in Jizan port. This show you that Yemeni now are actually will start a new stage by targeting Saudi main oil infrastructure in the Red Sea. And I think, if you let me may, they want to send four messages to Saudi Arabia. We know that there was a meeting between Netanyahu and Bombay and bin Salman. This is a message actually directly by naming this missile, Quds missile. This means a message to the Zionist state that Yemeni are standing behind the Palestinian and as well to have this new missile enter the service. This means as well that Yemeni army are well equipped and they will upgrade their weapons and they are ready to defend the country for many, many months or years to come. And as well is a message to Bombay and the United States for all this threat that Trump might put Ansarullah in the list, in the so-called blacklist. Sana'a is like saying, we don't care. That's why they targeted Jeddah. At the time, there was news that there was yesterday a meeting between Netanyahu and Bombay, as well Mohammed bin Salman.
So do you think, Michael Springman, that is true, that this in a sense and in a way is a message directed at not only Mohammed bin Salman, but also Netanyahu, and of course the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that you know, this is what we're capable of doing, and also in particular the U.S., who has threatened to put the Ansarullah fighters on a terrorism list.
Yeah, I think it's exactly right that it is sending a message, a very loud and a very clear message, because Jeddah is the Manhattan of Saudi Arabia. It's the former port city that most of the people doing the Hajj travel through, and they still use the airport behind Jeddah and near where the attacks took place with that missile, and that shows that they can reach out to one of the higher ranking cities in the country, the bread and butter, the money, the finance, and so forth in Saudi Arabia, and they can touch them. And I heard from Nasser Shaqqar this morning on the earlier report he'd done for Press TV that people were running around the explosion site, people from Jeddah, the native Saudis and the expatriates, of which there are many there, taking photographs, taking motion pictures with iPhones and whatever to record this and pass it around the kingdom and to their friends and abroad. I tried reaching out to contacts in Jeddah earlier today and failed, unfortunately, asking what their impression of this was. But I definitely think that it's not only a message to Pompeo, it's a message to Biden, and it should be he be confirmed as president on December 14th, because he's appointed Anthony Blinken, a Jew, according to the Washington Post, as Secretary of State. And Jews in American government support Israel more than they support the American government. Like her name, the Sigal Pearl Schalker, who had been Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, Sigal Pearl Mandel, I'm sorry. She was born and raised in Israel, yet her loyalty was there, and she was supposedly an American citizen, supposedly working for the interests of the American government. So yeah, they're telling the Americans loud and clear, stay out of this.
Jose Albuquerque, you know, this is not the first time that Saudi Arabia's most important asset and treasured asset has been targeted. We're looking at the second time, and overall, Saudi Arabia has been targeted with dozens of ballistic missiles and drone attacks since the start of the year. So if I'm sitting in Riyadh and I'm watching my most important asset be targeted, this being the second time, I would think twice about pursuing this war, because it may be a recurrence, as we're seeing it happen. Why does Saudi Arabia then in turn follow through on this war? Obviously, it's a very costly war, but it continues this war. It's 5 years old now. What are they getting out of it?
To be honest with you, I think we can to somehow blame the Sana'a government here, because most of the time after any major attack like Umm Bakik and any other area, we see that Yemenis here in Sana'a always like putting new like offers to Saudi Arabia to stop its war. I believe if Sana'a will come to a decision that Saudi does not actually want any peace in Yemen, they only want to protect their country, despite the fact that they are funding many terrorist group and militia here to fight Yemenis. So if Sana'a will take that decision to continue the attack, not to stop, they should not be actually patient with Saudi Arabia. We have seen Saudi Arabia many times. Yemen offered to stop all its war against Saudi Arabia in exchange of stopping their airstrike and lifting the blockade. The blockade is actually killing hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. Millions of Yemenis are in urgent need of food. That's why I think, as I said, some blame is coming to Sana'a. And there is one more important as well about this latest attack. It's as well a direct message to the Saudi regime that, you still think that the Red Sea will stay a safe haven for you to export your oil, maybe to avoid the Persian Gulf. As long as you are in war against Yemen, a blockade against Yemen, this means that Saudi Arabia actually is threatened the important shipping lane in the Red Sea, because they are using that shipping lane by sending their destroyer and sending their warship to have a blockade in Yemen. And by this attack, actually, I think that Yemenis are saying that they are actually well equipped to close this shipping lane, especially after the attack on Jizan with these two explosive boats. I just want to remind you that 3 years ago, a Yemeni army has actually used the same type of this boat targeting Saudi Al-Madina brigade. And you can imagine how strong that brigade is well equipped to defend itself, so it could not actually defend itself against this boat. That means that Saudi ships are actually in danger if they continue their war against Yemen.
Well, Michael Springman, our guest says that somehow the approach that the Yemeni army has and the central government has in Yemen shouldn't be so that they commit such an important attack and then subscribe to having negotiations or having some kind of resolve, perhaps, that it should not go through with that because Saudi Arabia has broken its promises. And he has said that Saudi Arabia supports groups within Yemen to fight against the Yemeni army. There have been talks in the past of reconciliation. Prisoner exchanges have also happened, but nothing has come out of it. Why are there not major strides being made when it comes to the political front of this war?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman and the people around him are basically stupid and arrogant and are probably something of narcissists. They think the world revolves around them and all they do is need to do is raise an eyebrow and something will be done. Unfortunately, they don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. All they see is more tunnel, and it's like digging a hole. After a while, you should stop digging. But unfortunately, they won't do it. Don't count the cost and their arrogance. They figure someone else will pay. The Saudis will get taxed. The average citizen will lose his stipend for necessities such as bread and gasoline and whatever. The prices are going to go up to them, and have in fact gone up in the past. So they won't stop until it's really rubbed in their face. If the Americans, for example, thought it was too dangerous to deal with Saudi Arabia, something might happen. for example, if the Yemenis dropped a couple of these missiles onto airports after issuing a notice to airmen saying, you land in Jeddah, you land in Riyadh at your own peril, and break up the runways and smash a few hangars and repair facilities, I think people would be not terribly inclined to go to Saudi Arabia. And the Americans might be inclined, at least the American government might be inclined, to stop the sales of weapons to keep the war in Yemen going.
Well, Senator Bogeti, so you said that somehow the Sana'a government is at fault because they follow through with or commit such an important attack, but yet they become a little open to perhaps negotiations. So if you were running the government in Sana'a, how would you approach this whole situation?
To be honest with you, I mean, clearly, since the day that the United Nations, as an example, has taken Saudi Arabia from a list for killing children, even though the name of Ansar al-Houthi is in that list, they have done that, the United Nations, twice. And on the third report, they actually thanked Saudi Arabia for, like, being more careful, not total killing kids. Yemeni government, actually, at that time, they should actually cut ties with the United Nations. They should not have met with the UN envoy to Yemen at that time, or this the current one, because this shows you that the United Nations actually is biased. And because Saudi threatened to cut the fund, it's like bribing and blackmailing the United Nations. And United Nations, for them, is okay for Saudi to kill Yemenis and to kill hundreds of thousands of starving Yemeni kids, but it's okay as well to take money from Saudi Arabia, as they say, to save another children. Those stand actually should be made really, really strong. And after the attack, as an example, on Pekik, which have actually knocked down 50% of Saudi oil. Just can you imagine if they have, for example, targeted Ras Tanura port in the Persian Gulf, which actually export 95% of Saudi chemical and oil and fuel to outside. If they have done those two steps, one step after the other, one without offering any peace to Saudi Arabia, I'm sure that the United Nations and the UK, and especially the United States, will actually try to stop this war, because they are making profit from this war. When they see that the Saudi is losing their oils, their economy can be collapsed. This means that they're going to lose one of their strongest allies in the region, and they cannot give the money for these weapons. I believe it will be really, really simple. If there is no profit from this war will end soon.
Michael Springman, we do have to talk about this as much as it is repeated. But, you know, you have these countries that are selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, the major one being the United States. We also have France and the U.K. I mean, I am sure these countries and their officials realize they have blood on their hands. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves, the humanitarian situation as a result of this war that has worsened, making it one of the worst humanitarian conditions that a country has in the world. But do you think, at least on the part of the U.S., if you have Biden be confirmed, that it's going to think twice about its approach to this war? Many hoping that the U.S. is going to end its role and then maybe even restore humanitarian aid? Or is that just a pipe dream?
Well, I think it's more hope than anything else. There's an awful lot of hope in a change of administration if, in fact, Joe Biden is confirmed on December 14th. However, you know, until the Americans start paying the price, either in image or in losing the military training mission headquartered in various places in Saudi Arabia, and port visits by American warships to Saudi ports, I think that it's going to continue. The Americans are going to ignore what's going on in Yemen because they can sell weapons to the Saudis and increase the bottom line of big American corporations and presumably preserve jobs in the midst of this virus hysteria where they just about shut down the American economy from coast to coast. So I think the Americans are going to keep on with it. Certainly Biden is not opposed to this. He keeps talking about how the Saudis should be treated as pariahs, but I've not seen anything concrete coming out of him saying definitely on the day after I've sworn in as president, I will end all American arms sales to Saudi Arabia. I put restrictions on visas for Saudis coming to the United States. And I will sanction Saudi companies. I will sanction Saudi Aramco. I will sanction Saudi government officials. We'll start seizing Saudi princes' airplanes if they enter American airspace, that kind of thing. That might achieve something. But until then, it's basically going to be more of the same, I'm afraid.
Well, Senator Bukhati, another aspect to this war, which some say is a war within a war, is the rift that exists between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Maybe you can explain that to us, where it stands now. It's been going on for quite some time and involves the southern front where the port of Aden is located.
To be honest with you, I don't think there is any rift between Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, because we know that those two countries, actually, we say in Yemen, they are a tool of the Zionist state, a tool of U.S. policy in the region. So, it will be really hard to believe that when they started this war, they joined this war all together with all the support from the United States, United Kingdom, and France, that they now are... could not actually force the group that they are fighting under their command to sit together and not to fight each other and to focus the fight on Ansarullah, the Houthi. The main reason is a UK policy since the occupation of Yemen or other region by Britain is divide and conquer, because those two countries actually does not want to have a united Yemen. They want to split Yemen, and as well the south of Yemen, they want to split it into groups. So Yemenis will keep fighting either in that region against each other, while United Arab Emirates is actually focusing on Bab el-Mandeb, on all the island in there, as well on Socotra Island, which there are news that Israel will have a base in there. And on the other hand, we see Saudi Arabia is focusing on Al-Mahra region and on Hadramaut region, because there are plans that Saudi Arabia want to install an oil pipeline, because the United States policy think that if they're going to come to any war with Iran in the future, they need to be in control of those areas under the control of United Arab Emirates, like Bab el-Mandeb and Socotra Island. And as well, Saudi Arabia might build this oil pipeline to avoid the Persian Gulf. That's why those tools actually cannot lose the goal or go out of the goal or the target that was set to them by the United States and UK. And I just want to add one more thing very quickly. Everybody should believe either Sana'a government that either it's Biden or Trump, the U.S. policy is one. We remember that the war in Yemen was actually announced from Washington by Saudi ambassador in there, and United States, the White House, under Trump, Obama administration has released a statement supporting this war, and they said we will be behind Saudi Arabia in this war. And it was Obama who actually received the Nobel Peace Prize. That's why it's all the same policy, and Saudis and United Arab Emirates is just a tool of that.
Thank you. Let me thank our guest, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, Michael Springman, and activist and political commentator, Hossein Al-Bukhati. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Kovat Atlas, goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to Light Upon Light. We would like to congratulate you on the birthday of our beloved Imam, the 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. And with me today to talk about this holy anniversary is my brother Sheikh Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum Sheikh, how are you doing, brother?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for having me. Alhamdulillah that we've been alive to feel again these lovely days and to be able to talk about Imam Askari.
Thank you for coming, my brother.
Thank you.
Now, the 11th Imam alayhi salam, and he lived in a very, very hard situations, as we know, and he's the father of our 12th Imam. What else do you have for us to talk about?
Well, the life of Imam Askari salawatullah alayhi is a strange life. When you go and study the history to see what has been narrated about Imam Askari salawatullah alayhi and how was the whole situation, the circumstances around the life of Imam alayhi salam, you become more and more familiar with the fact that with the last Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the situation of their lives, the difficulty and the hardships that they were about to face and encounter became much more severe and hard to tolerate. For instance, we see that after the time of Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq salawatullah alayhima, which was simply a good time, a good place and opportunity for them to talk about the Sharia, to spread the word of Allah.
Because of the revolt against the Umayyads and the beginning of the Abbasid Caliphate.
The change of power, yes. It was the period of time the power was being changed. So it was a good opportunity. But after that, from the life of Imam Kazim alayhi salam, after that Imam Reza salatullah alayhi, we see that Bani Abbas la'natullah alayhim, they saw and felt that the power of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam was growing so much. People had a lot of tendency and
popularity
love.
Was increasing.
Yes. And that popularity was absolutely a problem in their face and opposing their usurping rule that they had. So they forcibly, for example, moved Imam Reza salawatullah alayhi from Medina to Khorasan, right? After that, Imam Jawad alayhi salam too. And we see that from the early lives, from the childhood of Imam Askari salawatullah alayhi, Imam is in Samarra, as his father was moved to Samarra. Now, not like a normal place that the government has eyes on them, has, you know, spies on them, like in a military stronghold.
So Samarra was pretty much the military stronghold that the Abbasid Khalifa
had. And they moved Imam alayhi salam into that stronghold, a place completely protected and a place completely observed by a lot of eyes. So they wanted to make sure that Imam alayhi salam doesn't do anything that goes, you know, the opposite way of their favor. So from the beginning days, the life of Imam alayhi salam was that much difficult. For example, there's a narration. Ali ibn Ja'far says that we were waiting for Imam alayhi salam. One day Imam was going to step out from his place to go to the government office. We wanted to see Imam alayhi salam. We wanted to talk to him because, you know, imagining that situation, it's so difficult. So finding an opportunity to see your Imam, to talk to him, it's so relieving and lovely. But before Imam alayhi salam comes out, a letter came to us, and Imam alayhi salam said in that letter that, do not say hello to me, do not point to me even with your fingers, and do not do anything that implies your connection and your love to me, because you are not safe here. So he says that Imam alayhi salam stepped out and we didn't do anything. So see how difficult is it that even saying hi to Imam alayhi salam, which shows a little bit of connection between the two, can be a death penalty for a person in that area.
To emphasize the idea more, I think there's this narration that was stated by one of the companions of Imam al-Askar alayhi salam, when he stated that he ordered us to not even say salam to him while he's walking in the streets.
Yes.
And just to act like he's a stranger to them and that they don't know who he is actually. And that was just out of the fear that the Shias, the companions of the Imam, and the Imam had of the Abbasid Khalifa.
Of the rule of the government that time. So in this situation that we described a little bit, how can Imam alayhi salam have connection and how can Imam keep the contact with the Shia, with the world? How can Imam alayhi salam do the responsibilities which God has put on his shoulders? Well, we've talked about this before. The agency that Imam Kazim alayhi salam started also continued to the life of Imam Askari alayhi salam. So Imam alayhi salam, through this agency, through many people and officers that Imam alayhi salam assigned for different purposes and sent to different cities and countries to do Imam's bidding. So Imam Askari alayhi salam used this agency for a couple of purposes.